Speaker, and I understand we got one as an act of faith, but I understand we have, and you want everybody in the middle to be superb. Now, here's the part. Now, don't start that recording yet, because I'm going to do it now, but I have to say my name again. My name is Stan, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm about to introduce our main speaker, and that really gives me a great deal of pleasure. Indeed, more than Tom from North Carolina could ever know. You know the wonderful feeling that each of you get and I get when you hear somebody speak who tells an awful lot of your story. And more importantly, it tells you about feelings and about ideas and about what's happened in his life in terms of his God and things in his life. And I was glued as I listened to Tom speak. And I was just so delighted when Keith came and said that we could entertain the idea of having Tom B. Jr. from North Carolina come and share at this conference. I was delighted. And when I heard Tom speak, I said, you betcha. And he's our banquet speaker, and I really want him here. And I want now for you, everyone here, to give the very warmest Ontario Regional Conference welcome to our guest speaker tonight, Tom B. from North Carolina. Tom?
My name is Tom Brady, Jr. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
My wife told me not to get up there with this gum, and I did it anyway. So much for instructions from my wife. I'm an alcoholic, but I don't drink. That always tickles me. Yeah.
The lightning missed.
I'll tell you when to get the rim shots. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. How many alcoholics in here? Let me see your hand. That's a lot of damn self-centeredness. And I'm going to have all the attention for the next hour, so eat your heart out. There's a line in the book, Buck, that I take exception to, where one fellow says, I have since found that these principles will solve all of my problems. Well, they won't solve a bladder problem. And I've got one. And there's always a helpful Al-Anon around when you have a bladder problem. And I was telling Liz about my bladder problem, and she says, that's easy, we'll send out for a catheter kit if it gets real bad. I mean, she had it all figured out. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't do anything for my bladder, but it has changed my life. It has transformed me beyond my wildest dreams. It is without doubt the finest and most effective life-changing program on the face of God's earth. And His hand moves large in this room. All of us have been touched. It's a room full of miracles. It's a room full of people that should not be sober. People like me who left to my own devices would have been dead long ago of my illness. And I'm not. Matter of fact, I'm free. I don't have to control anybody in this audience. I don't have to control anybody anywhere. Everything I have in my life is a gift. Nothing belongs to me. I'm free. Chris Christopherson and Janis Joplin both sang a song called Me and Bobby McGee. And there's a line in that song which says what I'm trying to say. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. We had a great, great and wonderful man in the States who ended one of his great and wonderful sermons one time with these words, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, I'm free at last." Who better than we can feel those words and feel the truth in them and know the truth in them beyond intellect and beyond ego. Deep inside, be very grateful, even if we don't understand how it happened. And I don't. Our book talks about an arch that we build through which we pass to freedom. It talks about the stones in that arch being the steps of this program. And later on, the steps themselves becoming the path that leads us to freedom. And I want to talk with you about that tonight, son. I'm going to share with you. And I'm going to share with you me, which is all I've got. And I'm going to share with you the things that have gone on in my life which have made me a true believer in this program and which have served to transform me and change me. And to move me in the direction of the kind of person that I really always wanted to be in the first place. And the things that have made me very grateful for this. I stand up here in front of you and I remember my roots. I was born and raised in a very small textile mill village down in eastern North Carolina. And most of the people in North Carolina don't know where Irwin is, and Irwin was my hometown. And my father ran the company store, and my mother worked in the mill and did everything else. My mother is a phenomenal woman. My mother is a black belt Southern Baptist. My mother is brilliant. She's strong. She's dominant. She's 82 going on 18. For many years, if my mother had had her choice, she would have breathed for me. And she's a hell of a woman. If the chief executive officer of AT&T died tomorrow, my mom could take over. Matter of fact, if God died tomorrow, my mom could take over. She's had her eyes on that office for a long time. And I remember my block. Everybody on that block was my family. The Sewells on the right-hand side, Bill and Lena Sewell and their three children. The Beards on the left-hand side and their three children. I remember Martha Lucas that lived down the street. I never will forget Martha Lucas. She's the first person I ever played doctor with. I'll never forget Bill Sewell. Bill didn't like to bathe. And when his mom would try to bathe him, he would escape. She'd come out on the front porch and she was a large lady and she would say, "Tommy, he's loose again." And there would go Bill down the street, no clothes on. Spent half my life chasing Bill Sewell. Wonder where he is. Probably running down some street with no clothes on. And I liked it there. And I used to lay outside my mom's kitchen window while she was cooking that Eastern North Carolina soul food. Collard greens with fatback in them. Everybody eats fatback in a mill village. You can't afford chicken. And I'd lay up in the cheney ball tray outside the window and I'd reflect. Y'all ever reflect when you were children? And I'd reflect, it's nice here. I really like it around here. My mom and dad are good people. My neighbors are good people. Had a doctor that knew every inch of my body. You remember those days when he had one doctor who did everything? Dr. Parker? And I'd say to myself, but something's missing. And I don't know what it is. And I don't know where to find it. But God, when I find it, that's going to be something. I was a disgustingly perfect child. And my mother told me one time that she had never seen an ugly baby until I was born. I told the psychiatrist that once, and he said, "Ooh, that must have been traumatic for you." I said, "No, sir, it wasn't traumatic. I've seen my baby pictures. Mom was right. I was ugly." Lisa, my wife, didn't believe my mom had said that, so I checked it out just a few months ago. I said, "Mom, was I easy to deliver? I was taking a, you know, like an alcoholic does, a different approach." And she said, "Yes, son," said, "you were." Said, "but while I was carrying you, you wanted to get out so bad, you almost kicked me off the bed several times. Don't know what business you had out there, but you really wanted to get to it." And she said, "the night you were born, I called Dr. Parker about midnight, and I told him that I felt like you were coming. He said, 'Fine, walk on across to the hospital, and I'll meet you there.'" Said, 4:30 in the morning, you came out, son. No trouble at all. She said, "but Tommy, you sure were ugly." I was skinny, one of those skinny kids, you know. Always wanted to be macho. Any of you guys out there honest enough to know that you wanted to be macho? Manly. My mother had a brother, his name was Durwood. They called him Dud for short. Dud was a motorcycle cop in the days when they wore riding breeches and spats up to their knees, and he had a leather harness across here with silver bullets in it and a pearl handle 38 sitting up on his hip, and he squeaked when he walked. And he smelled like gunpowder and shaving lotion, you know? That's macho. And I wanted to be like that. I grew this great shock of snow white hair. Do you know what my uncles and everybody else call me? Puddinhead. It is difficult to be macho when people call you Puddinhead. Want to guess what my wife calls me these days? Puddinhead. Puddin' do this, puddin' do that. I think she's forgotten what my name is. And I love it, but I didn't love it then. I was very skinny. One guy wrote a book called Sobriety and Beyond. I'm going to write one called Skinny and Ugly and Beyond. And I got the feeling my mom didn't really like me because mom made me wear knickers. Any fellas have to wear knickers? Brown corduroy knickers. And my leg was this big and the knicker hole was this big. I spent half my life pulling up those knickers. And that wasn't macho. And I had freckles. Now don't get me wrong, I love freckles as long as they're on other people. I had them everywhere. I had them places where I've never heard a report of a person having a freckle, but I had them. And I hated them. No one too fond of me. And I used to figure it's the freckles. If I can ever get rid of the freckles, everything's going to be all right. Along about 12 or 13, I got rid of them. They were replaced with the darndest set of pimples you ever saw in your life. Other kids had little zits, you know, little old things. I had cysts and balls, you know. What you call in a mill village, I had risins. Mom and Dad were old-fashioned people. Always told me if I did certain things, I was going to have a bumpy face. Used to swear I didn't do those things. How would you feel if you walked down the street and it's like you got to look at your face, you know, and they know what you're doing? Like you got a neon sign over your head. Say, he's doing it. He's doing it. He's doing it. And I was good at it. It's funny now. Wasn't funny then. Used to go in the bathroom and take my daddy's razor and shave the side of my face off. My dad was a beautiful human being. Gorgeous. One of my goals in life is to be more like my dad. Quiet, gentle, kind. A nice man. Dad was a good-looking man. He was slim. He had coal black hair, wavy. Mom had dark brown hair, wavy. My sister had brown hair, wavy. I had white hair, and it was straight. And I wondered if I belonged. And I even asked if I belonged. And I didn't believe him when he told me I did. And I felt outside, and I felt alone. And because I wasn't what I visualized in my mind I really wanted to be, I began to feel like a failure. And I come home bringing my report card as an offering for approval. And the eyes would go over the straight A's, and it was always straight A's. And jump down to the conduct section. And instead of, son, this is a wonderful deal here, these straight A's. It was, let's raise these others. It wasn't a negative thing. It was, let's raise the C's. And I began to feel like I'm a failure here, too. And I wonder if I'm ever going to find it. This thing that's missing, this thing I'm longing for. I wonder. I realized long after I was in the program that I had been angry for a long, long time, and I had not the slightest idea what I was angry at. I had been afraid for most of my life, and if you asked me why I was afraid, I could not have told you. You know, we so hung up on the whys in this program, and I heard a man say something not long ago I'll pass along to you. He said, I've still found after years in the program there's only one answer to the word why, the question why, and it's because. We get so hung up on the why am I afraid, why am I guilty, why am I depressed, why am I angry? We live in a society that stresses this. We must understand everything before we can do something about it. And yet this program says it's the reverse. You do something about it, and then you begin to understand it. You practice the principles, and then you may understand the why. And if you don't, who cares? It's over with. But you see, we've learned. We've learned. We've gotten so psychological. And so reason, and so, you know, rational and intellectually oriented. You know, you go to a doctor and you're paying this sucker $100 an hour. And you sit there and you cross your legs. And he jumps across the desk at you almost, you know, mentally and says, why did you cross your legs? Now you're paying the man $100 an hour. So you got to think up a good reason. You know? So you say, well, doctor, you know, it was my potty training. That always gets their attention. You know that? Or it was my mama. Mama always gets their attention. And our program does not teach this, as far as I'm concerned. I got to tell you about an experience I had in the Baptist church one morning. A little white wood Baptist church in Irving, North Carolina, the Mill Village. Forrest Maxwell was the preacher. And the music was good that morning. And he preached a good sermon that morning. Stained glass windows were just right that morning. And the nicest, warmest feeling came over me. It was like a warm shower that came down all around me. And something inside me said, this is it. Whatever it is I've been looking for, wow, this is it. I didn't feel ugly. I didn't feel like a failure. I felt like I belonged. All the negatives disappeared in one great shower of positive. Problem was, it didn't last. It didn't last. When I was 15 years old, I was in the King Cotton Hotel in Greensboro, North Carolina, with a group of older men, experienced men. They were 17, 18 years old. And we were at a high school singing festival that we used to have up there every year. We'd have a huge choir, 700 voices singing. Gorgeous, good experience. I enjoyed it. I loved to sing. And I'm with my friends in this hotel room, and they called a cab driver and gave him $7.50, and a little while later he came back with a brown bottle of brown fluid in his hands. And the label said, cream of Kentucky. Now, I shall never forget that. And I asked the wisest man in the bunch, and his name really was Egghead Baker. People think I'm kidding when I say Egghead Baker was the wisest in the bunch. I said, Egghead, what do we do with this? And by this time, my name had changed. They were calling me Sweet Lips now. Also not very macho. He says, you drink a water glass of this as fast as you can, and you drink a glass of water as fast as you can, and you keep on doing that, and you're going to feel good. And I walked in the bathroom and I stood in front of the mirror, and I can picture it now, and I watched myself take my first drink. And something in me said, this is it. Whatever it is I've been looking for, this is it. And when everybody else got sick and passed out, I called the cab driver, I gave him 7.50, and I got me a pint of cream of Kentucky. I had found the answer. And for the next 15 years, I drank and I drank and I drank, trying to regain the feeling that I had that first time, and I never, ever found it. I had made straight A's up to this point. That stopped. I hadn't played sports. That stopped. Everything stopped that wasn't connected with alcohol. And I'm 15 and 16 years old. My life began to be dominated by it. And like the prodigal son, I headed off into the far country, believing that the answer was there. Someday, somehow, if I just handled it right, I'm going to be able to drink this stuff, and I'm going to be able to get that good effect, that warm shower coming all down around me, and I'm not going to have any bad side effects, and I'm not going to have any after effects, and I was having some terrible side effects and after effects. I staggered a lot. I drove drunk a lot. I got in jail a lot. I was forever waking up in places with bars on the windows. I didn't know if it was the jail or the zoo, and it didn't make much difference. I didn't want to be there, and I didn't choose to be there. All I wanted to do was the effect produced by alcohol. I wanted that, and I wanted it more than anything I'd ever had. By the time I was 23, I'd had over 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone as a result of drinking. I had been in psychiatric wards. There's an experience. I loved it in the psychiatric ward. It's an egomaniac's paradise. Do you know that? And I went into psycho ward, and there was a fellow walking down the hall with a Bible in his hand, and he was opening the door and asking for God. I said, something's wrong with this man. And there was another one, a friend of mine, who would be walking down the hall, perfectly sane, it seemed, and all of a sudden would stop and freeze in catatonia. I knew where I was, and I knew who I was. But in my own way, I was more insane. I believe today that people go insane as a survival mechanism. The world is so terrible that they create their own world and they live in it, and no one can get in and mess with them. My insanity was self-destruct. But I fit right in. As an alcoholic, I don't know about you other alcoholics, I was like a rock lizard. Whatever you wanted me to be, I'd be. And I tried to out-nut the nuts when I was in the psychiatric ward. And I learned how to play crazy eight and sit around the table and take those drugs that they all took so often, you know, and I liked them. They were good. Learned about all the antidepressants, Trilofan and that like, you know. And when people are taking Trilofan, you know they're on Trilofan because they shuffle up and down the hall all day long. I shuffled for days and days. I was thrown out of the psychiatric ward. I went to a religious home for alcoholics. That was a trip. The treatment consisted of preaching on Tuesday night, Thursday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning, and Sunday night. Now, folks, you haven't heard anything till you heard a bunch of drunks testify. And before we got dinner on Sunday, we all had to testify. And the man sitting there that ran the place, you know, he'd grin when you'd testify. And the more he grinned, the more pleased he was, you know. And everybody got to out-testify everybody else. It's almost like a discussion meeting in AA, you know. We formed a gospel quartet down there, and I sang in it. Called ourselves the Four Roses. Truth. I went through that place twice. Must have enjoyed it a lot. And three members of that gospel quartet are now sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the other, who was a wonderful man, Methodist minister, OD'd and was pulled out of a ditch. And I miss him. Just realize that. I was a mess at a very early age. But I was obsessed with alcohol. Obsessed in the sense that our book talks about. Convinced that someday, somehow, I would enjoy and control my drinking. I was obsessed in that sense. And I'm an alcoholic in the sense that the book talks about. I could not take alcohol in my system without developing the phenomenon of craving. I understand the allergy. I understand the obsession. I lived it. And I couldn't stop. I went to AA when I was 23. Don't know why I went. Somebody pushing on me, I guess. Another drunk driving offense. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and I made a quick study like I always did, and I am an intellectual, you know. That's what real low-bottom drunks are, intellectuals. The one sign I can't stand in an AA meeting is think, think, think. I want to run up there and write, don't, don't, don't. I went in this meeting and there was 12 steps on a plaque on this side and 12 traditions on a plaque on this side, and a man standing up front with a blue book in his hand, and everybody was listening to him. Now, I've always been the kind of a person that likes to be up front and stand in front of people. I'm an alcoholic. That means I like being number one. I read pages 60 to 62 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and it talks about me being an actor who likes to control the whole show. I cop to that. Absolutely. And I figured to myself, if you memorize those steps and memorize those traditions and memorize what's in that book, they'll put you up front and they'll listen to you. And I think I remember saying to myself, you ought to be president of AA within 6 months. And so I memorized the steps. And I memorized the tradition. And to this day, I can quote great portions of this book to you. But I don't have to anymore. You hear what I'm saying? I don't have to anymore. However, if you're ever in a big book discussion meeting with me, do not misquote this book. And they put me up front and started listening to me. I delivered some windy dissertations. Man, I talk on axiology and ontology and epistemology. The vigorology I could get, the more it would wow these old guys. After all, they needed their intellects uplifted. For the next 7 years, with all of this head knowledge, the longest I ever stayed dry was 89 days. 89 days. And I know it was 89 days because in North Carolina we give a red poker chip for 90 days of sobriety. And I wanted one of those things. I wanted one so bad I've been up after meetings and stolen one out of the chip box. And I had one pasted on the calendar on the 90th day. 89 days I stayed dry, and the 90th day I rested. You talk about suffering, going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's like my friend Chuck from California used to say, I stood there and I watched the turtles of life pass me by like they were riding motorcycles. And I'm this close to the switch of sobriety, Keith, and I cannot reach it, and I'm not trying not to reach it. I am trying to reach it. And I remember, you've been a failure all your life, boy. Are you going to fail at this too? And I met some hateful people in AA. Old timers. Most of them ugly. I met one in this group and his name was Bill C. And I called him Grumpy and I hated his guts. He always called me boy. And he always pointed at me. And he could see through me like he had x-ray vision, the man did. I'd go into a meeting and he'd say, how you doing, boy? And I'd tell him how I was doing. And he would tell me I was lying, and then he'd tell me how I was doing. And he talked in circles, you know? You know? It took me a long time to realize all spiritual teachers talk in circles, folks. Some call them parables. And the old man would say, boy, you don't think your way into good living. You'd live your way into good thinking. And I'd think, you stupid SOB. Don't you think I know anything? And he used to kill me with this one. Boy, he'd say, how come you always run around looking for God? He ain't lost. Hateful man. Now I'm an alcoholic. I meet somebody like that, I've got to convert them. So I went on a big 12-step call one day. The guy's a wino. Any winos and winettes out there? The guy had been laying up in a log cabin drunk for about 4 months. It was a mess. And I jumped in there and I got a lady from down the street and we cleaned that place up and he was turning blue. We got him off to a doctor, you know. Got him back, he was going to live, the place was clean. I called Grumpy. I wanted Grumpy to come see what I had done for this man. And in going through all that mess, cleaning out that log cabin, I had found a gallon of wine. And when Grumpy got there, I was drunk too. And I remember the night that Grumpy did me the largest favor that any human being's ever done me on the face of this earth, and I mean this. I called him, and I never called him before. I always called him after I was drunk. And he said, "Boy, don't you ever call me drunk again." He said, "As a matter of fact, don't you ever call me again. If you want to get sober, you know where we meet, and don't call me to come get you. You can walk as far as I'm concerned." And he said, "Frankly, I don't care if you ever get sober." Now that hurt my feelings. I'm a sensitive drunk. God bless him. He's dead now. And I visited him just before he died, and I think I'd been sober 17 years then. And he looked at me and he pointed his finger at me and he said, "Boy, you'll never make it." Knowing Grumpy was a humbling experience. He could humble you in a minute. Let me talk about teachers for a minute, please. Or maybe I'll get back to it. Remind me if I don't. We have some fantastic teachers in this program. The least likely human beings on the face of the earth can take you directly to your brother and sister and directly to your God. People that point their fingers at you and call you boy or girl. Mean people, ugly people, people that got bad perspiration odor, people got bad breath can take you right to God, help you move to that switch of sobriety and turn that sucker on and keep it burning. It's phenomenal. I drank on until I was 30. Not that I wasn't trying to get sober. I got into meditation one time. I used to sit and cross my legs up all funny, you know. Get in the lotus position. I can get in it fine. I just can't get out of it. But I knew what the good meditators did. They sat down and crossed the legs up all funny and chanted, you know. Sounded like Om to me, so I said Om. And I sat there and waited for my spiritual awakening to happen. And nothing happened. And I'm a Baptist now. I know what a spiritual awakening is. You know, God knocked Paul off a jackass. Changed his name. He lit up a bush for Moses. I figured he could give me one lightning bolt. God's got a terrific sense of humor. I can almost see him looking down and saying to Peter, "There he is again." Got his legs all crossed up funny and chanting. Can't get out of that position. Waiting for a lightning bolt. Got lots of lightning bolts here. Be happy to give him one. But he wouldn't like the color. July 20th, 1965, I came to. And I realized for the first time in my life the impact and the import of the first step of this program. Because that morning I knew I could not drink and I could not quit drinking. I began to understand what powerlessness means, Keith. I can't drink and I can't quit drinking. And I am going to die. Now by this time I'm on 5 years probation. And I'm never supposed to drive in my state again. And I tried AA and it hadn't worked. I'm different. I'm a failure. I didn't consider myself better than those people. I considered myself worse than those people. Had it been left up to my mind, I never would have come back here. You ever noticed how you can argue with your mind? We call it thinking. You know, I think I'll do this, no I won't. I think I'll do that, no I won't. You ever notice how you cannot argue with your body? When my body wants me to do something, I do it. When it wants me to sleep, I sleep. When it wants me to stop and I don't stop, I say I don't have time to stop. It makes me sick, I stop. I cannot argue with my body. We got a songwriter from North Carolina named James Taylor, and there's a line in one of his songs that says, I guess my feet know where they want me to go. Mine did, and they carried me dead back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat on the back row, and I got there late, and I left early. I didn't speak to anybody. I didn't figure they had time for me. But they spoke to me. They found out I didn't have a driver's license, and I got calls every day. People wanted to take me to a meeting. I kept going. And I got watching this man there, and I liked him. I liked his eyes especially. What is spiritual in me and what is spiritual in you will show itself in the eyes. I believe that. And this man had good eyes. And I went up to him one night, and I said, I don't want to die, or mumble something like that. And would you be my sponsor? And he turned to me, and he pointed his finger at me. And he said, boy, I have heard about you. They tell me you're crazy. Ah, but he says, I'll help you on one condition. And I said, what's that? He said, we will do it my way. I said, yes, sir. Now, he says, the first thing I would like you to do is come to meetings early. And I want you to go around and shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing. And I said, I don't want to come to meetings early. And I don't want to shake their hands, and I don't care how they're doing. I just don't want to die. And why do I have to do that? And he said, boy, you don't ask me why. You do what I tell you to do, or the deal is off. And I did it. Marvelous experience, shaking hands. Marvelous experience. When I first started doing it, I mumbled because I didn't want to. I'd have skipped some, but I knew he was watching me, and he'd make me go back, and it'd be embarrassing. Walls and ceilings and everywhere, but at people, I couldn't stand to look at anybody because they might see me. And I hated me. And gradually my eye level came up and my voice cleared up a little bit, and I saw some shins, and then I saw some knees, and a few more weeks I saw some thighs, a few more weeks I saw some hips. And then the wonderful thing happened. I was looking them in the eyes and I was shaking their hands, and I did care how they were doing. And they did too. In the nicest, warmest shower came down all over me. And something deep inside said, this is really it. This is really it. This is a we program. The first word in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in the foreword of the original book is the word we. And that's relevant because I have an I illness, an illness of separation, alienation, egocentricity, selfishness, self-centeredness, and all of its children. And the reason I couldn't reach the switch was because I was trying to reach it alone. With just a little bit of help, I reached it. And I had some strange teachers. One of my teachers is Buck's sponsor, who doesn't teach with words. He's beyond that. Man been sober longer than God. But isn't it funny, if you picked up the yellow pages and looked for spiritual teachers, would you look for a playboy lawyer? That's what my sponsor was. Worked 3 days a year just to break the monotony. Would you look under there? People will tell you about God and how to live comfortably with yourself. People will teach you about freedom. Would you look for an 84-year-old machinist? Would you look for a fellow who sold brake shoes on railroad trains? Would you look for a Texas oil millionaire named Bob? Bob, the only man in the world ever called me sugar and got away with it. First time I ever met that man, he picked me up in his arms and hugged me and kissed me. And grinned at me and said, how you doing, sugar? I said, what's your trip? Or something like that.
I mean, down the middle village in eastern North Carolina, you don't hug your daddy after you're a certain age, much less have a man kiss you. Call me Sugar. Sit me down and say, Sugar, you know what the most important thing in the world is, the most wonderful thing in the world? And you're going to find it out one day. And I said, what, Bob? He said, somebody's going to say to you, Tom, I love you. And you're going to respond instead of giving them 10 reasons why they shouldn't. You're going to respond with, yeah, I know you do. And I love you too. Any of y'all like that? When somebody comes up and tells you they love you, do you have to say, really? Do you have to say, how can you love me? When somebody tells you you're doing a good job, do you have to give them a number of reasons why you should have done better? I've learned that in me, all of that springs out of my self-hate. Even in my drinking years, when things got good, that was bad. When my life got going smooth, something deep inside of me almost would say out loud, mess it up. Our book says we build up a rosy future for ourselves and our family and pull the whole structure down around our heads. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Why do we do this? Why do we do this? Because. You know what I was longing for when I sat in that Cheney ball tree when I was a kid? The same thing Augustine longed for. You've made us for yourself, dear Lord, he said, and our souls are restless until they rest in you. The same thing the psalmist was longing for when he said, as the deer longs for the clear streams of water, so longs my soul for you, O God. The same thing that the country music singer was writing about when he wrote these words, I want to go home. I want to go home. Lord, I want to go home. And Carl Jung said in a letter to Bill Wilson that our craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of a natural thirst of our being for union with God. Yeah, I want to go home. I've never met anyone who doesn't want to go home. I want to go home is almost a metaphor for spirituality. But I didn't know how to get there. I had no path. I had no guides. I had no fellow travelers. And in my past life, I had this thought about this home as being way over yonder, as they say, as the Baptists say, way across Jordan somewhere. That's where it is. That's where you're going. Well, I wasn't across Jordan that morning in the Baptist church when the warm shower came on me. I wasn't across Jordan when I was shaking that hand that night in the AA meeting and I said, this is it. This really is it. I was there. And what I was doing was very, very important. I was touching, reaching out for one of God's other creations. And every single time, folks, in my life, I have reached out in love for another of God's creations, God is there. I'm running off over yonder and over yonder, like Grumpy said, looking for God. And like my friend Chuck used to say, another one of my teachers, God's got a great sense of humor because he hid himself in the last place and we knew we'd ever look, right in the middle of us. And the greatest of spiritual teachers have told us this. You want to find God, they said, reach out for your brother. If you're going to church to worship and you remember you have something against your brother or your sister, go straighten that out first. Love God with all your heart, soul, body, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Learn to love horizontally, and the vertical relation will come, and right in the intersection of those two lines is home. That's what you've always been looking for. Dr. Bob knew it. He says you boil these steps down to the last, and they resolve themselves into two things, love and service. God is love. Service is an expression of that love. Our book says my job is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and those about me. Why are you always running around looking for God? He ain't lost. I looked in the wrong place. And I've got a path. There's no finer path than the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholism is a detour on the path home. A dead end, literally. And I've got a path. And I've got guides. People ask me, what is a sponsor? I say, he's a guide. A guide for what? What do you mean? I say, well, if you're in Charlotte, North Carolina, and you want to go to Los Angeles, and you've never been there before, you ask somebody who's been there a lot of times, and you say, it's really a life and death matter for me to get from Charlotte to Los Angeles. Can you take me there? He says, sure. That's what a sponsor is. He knows how to get you from Charlotte to Los Angeles. No detours, you know? He's been through all the ruts. He's hit all the bumps. He knows where the speed traps are. He can say, don't do that. Don't do that. Do this, do this, do this. We got the finest set of guides on the face of the earth and sponsors. Ah, but we're such picky people, aren't we? We have to find a person who is perfect to be our sponsor. And recovery for me has been a journey. From sickness to wellness. It's a strange process. I got a boy named Jason. Y'all heard me talk about him before. He was the potty chair philosopher. When Jason was being potty trained, he wanted one of us to sit there and talk to him. And I listened to children. Children and spiritual teachers are just like that. They say the same things, only in different ways. And I'm sitting there with my son one night, and out of nowhere, this kid looks up at me from his potty chair and says, hey, Dad, God turns the power on. And my reaction was, whoa. I said, how do you know that? Did your mother tell you? He said, no, sir. I said, you hear it at Sunday school? No, sir. I said, how do you know such a thing? He says, I just know. That's why. So do we. Do you remember the time when all the stops were out? When you knew you couldn't drink and you couldn't quit? When you knew that it was death or insanity? Did something in you know exactly and precisely where to turn? And did you hear yourself saying the following words in some form, God, oh God, please help me? Man, we've got a home and instinct. It's a home and instinct. Prayer is an instinct. Meditation is an instinct. We are expressions of the Creator. And we act like beggars. And we've got the path, and we've got the guide, and we've got directions. Boy, have we got directions in this book. Very explicit directions. Not my set, not your set. The directions. Not my program, your program. The program. My boy said to me another time, and if you could see him now, he's about this high. We're sitting on the couch one night, and he turns to me and he says, Dad, why don't I be the dad for a while and you be the son? I said, well, how do we work that out? And he says, it's simple. He says, I'll grow up and be the father. You grow down and be the child. To this day, that's the best description I've ever heard of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Growing down to be a child. See, spiritual growth is not a matter to me of growing up. It's a matter of growing down. And the greatest spiritual teachers have told us this. Meister Eckhart said, the soul does not grow by addition, it grows by subtraction. And the founders of this program did not talk about ego inflation, did they? They talked about ego deflation, meaning cut down to size. And the carpenter, when his boys were asking who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, he said, it's not a question of who's going to be the greatest. Bring that kid over here. And they brought the kid over, and he says, unless you become just like this little child, you're not even going to get there. Growing down. Spiritual growth is a process of growing down. Growing down toward what? Toward anonymity. toward the point where I don't have to be better than you. I don't have to control you. I don't have to compare myself to you in any way. To the point where when we walk into an AA meeting, you may be world famous and I am nobody, and we walk in that group and we are absolutely, totally, completely equal. And I'm talking anonymity as the spiritual foundation of this program. I'm not talking about hiding behind a mask. I'm talking about loving openly, freely, out loud. It's a wonderful program. It has taken me. It is transforming me. My journey is not over. But I have been home many, many, many times. Which of you has not? Want to see me go home? Put on some gospel music. At the right time. Huh? Put it on another time, nothing happens. Put it on at the right time, and I think it's grace. I think God chooses that time, and the nicest, warmest shower comes across me. Any manic depressives out there? The kind Dr. Silkworth talks about in here that a whole chapter could be written about. I used to be infuriated he didn't write a whole chapter about us. I get depressed. I work on it. I try to out-depress everybody else. I scuffle my feet and kick rocks and mumble profanities under my breath. And even that does not stop grace. I was walking in the park not long ago and I was scuffing my feet. I had my lip down to here, man. I done kicked off a good depression. I was saying some real profanities, you know. God don't care, nobody cares. You know how it is, poor little me. Some people came walking through the park. Obviously mentally retarded people. No, obviously truly mentally retarded. One of them was a huge black man, and he saw me, and he turned, and he grinned, and he waved at me, and he said, "Hey, how you doing?" And the nicest, warmest shower came all over me, and the depression was gone. You understand what I'm saying here? Grace. It's that power that works for me 24 hours a day, but I'm not aware of it because I'm asleep. This program is supposed to teach me to be awake. It's teaching me to be awake because I am asleep. Our 10th steps where it says we continue to watch. Stop right there. I take time sometime, a couple of hours during a day, and I watch for the good things that happen to me and for me that I don't have anything to do with. I can see grace working in my life. See it. When it can't be manufactured. I am a much blessed man. I'm a twice born man. Our book talks about rebirth. I'm a good man. I'm not ugly. I'm not a failure. And I'm learning to let you love me as much as I love you. And that was the hard part. You see, the word on me for years was, don't ask Tom for the shirt off his back. He'll give it to you. But don't try to give him yours. He can't take it. Now I'm going to say something. I need you. I need you every day. I need to be here now doing this. God needs me to be here now doing this. I know that. I am necessary. You are necessary. God is necessary. The program is necessary to bring all of us together and to take us in from the far country, perhaps into much of heaven and the fourth dimension
of existence, of which many of us have not even dreamed. Isn't that what our book says? And I love this program. If anything, I'm addicted to this program, and I make no apology for that whatsoever. You can shoot me up on this program every day, and I cannot OD. And I love you. I do. I really do. I have a love affair going with my mother, and with my wife, and with you. And I'd like to close with a song by my friend James Taylor, which maybe will express more than everything I've said tonight to you about how I'm feeling right now. I don't know what I've said. I don't care. What I was supposed to say has been said. And the song goes like this. I needed the shelter of someone's arms, and there you were. I needed someone to understand my ups and downs, and there you were, with sweet love and devotion, deeply touching my emotions. I gotta stop and thank you, baby. I just gotta stop and thank you, baby, how sweet it is to be loved by you. I close my eyes at night, wondering where I would be without you in my life. Everything I did was just a bore. Everywhere I went, it seemed I'd been there before. But you brighten up for me all of my days with love so sweet in so many ways. I gotta stop and thank you, baby. How sweet it is to be loved by you. Love from the Mill Village. God loves you too. Thank you.
Now, you know why I asked Tom to come up and speak to us and share with us tonight. You know, it's a miracle, as Tom pointed out. It clearly is. As I was listening to him speak, I couldn't help but think that fellow by the name of Puddinhead, with thousand stitches in his face by the time he was 23 years old, and shuffling down the corridors with a bunch of other loonies, and finding that beautiful bottle of wine in that shack somewhere, that he would actually come through a miracle to be here tonight with us to celebrate his 53rd born birthday, original real birthday. And I'd like you all just to help with the way Ontario Regional Conference people thank people. I'd like you to join in my celebration tonight. And I'd like you all to stand up and sing happy birthday to Tom with me, if you will. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Tom. Happy birthday to you. We all got together, Tom, before you arrived and chipped in. We would like you to take this small token, and it is, of our appreciation, and with it, the depth, which it is, of our heartfelt thanks for you coming up here and sharing with us tonight. Thank you, Tom. Just before we close the meeting, I'd just like to tell you that we've got a whole evening of celebration planned for you, with great music and dancing and fellowship and camaraderie and sharing that will continue after we're through here. But we will need to have you clear out the room so we can get ready for that celebration. And also, you who have joined us downstairs, you will need to clear out too. Does that come through on the screen all right? Clear out from downstairs in the front of that room as well. We've had a great night. I've really enjoyed it. Again, I thank you for the honor and the privilege for chairing the conference. And I'd like those of you who would to join me now in saying the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back.